In a world where nuclear war has already decimated the Northern Hemisphere, the people of Melbourne, Australia live on borrowed time. The radioactive cloud moves inexorably southward, following global wind patterns with scientific precision. There's no dramatic escape possible, no last-minute salvation, just the quiet certainty of extinction within months. What would you do if you knew exactly when the world would end? How would you spend your final days when all future has been eliminated? Neville Shute's haunting masterpiece doesn't show us the war itself, no dramatic explosions or heroic last stands. Instead, we witness the aftermath through ordinary people who weren't directly involved but must bear the consequences nonetheless. Gardens are still planted, though they'll never see harvest. Jobs continue, though paychecks have lost meaning. Children's birthday presents are bought for celebrations that will never come. This focus on the mundane aspects of life in the face of extinction delivers a message more powerful than any mushroom cloud. In nuclear war, there are no winners, no safe havens, and ultimately, no survivors. Mary Holmes plants perennials that won't bloom until after radiation reaches Melbourne. She discusses paint colors and plans renovations for next year. These aren't acts of denial, but rituals maintaining sanity through familiar domestic rhythms. Submarine commander Dwight Towers copes differently, speaking of his deceased wife and children in present tense. His shopping expeditions are particularly poignant, spending hours searching for his daughter's wanted pogo stick or selecting his son's upcoming birthday gift. These aren't delusions, but acts of remembrance, preserving his identity as husband and father. When Peter Holmes brings home government-issued suicide pills, Mary's violent rejection, "Are you trying to tell me what I've got to do to kill Jennifer?" captures a mother's primal resistance to harm her child, even when that harm might be mercy. Her flight from the room, hands pressed against her ears, embodies our visceral reaction to unbearable truth. The relationship between Commander Dwight Towers and Moira Davidson forms the emotional heart of the story. Their connection develops gradually, beginning with a sailing mishap that creates an unexpected moment of vulnerability. Later, as they sit in darkness, Moira breaks down over all she'll never experience. Paris, children, growing old. Their relationship's poignancy stems from its impossibility. Dwight remains psychologically committed to his dead wife Sharon, speaking of her in present tense and keeping her photograph. When Moira notices his damaged socks and missing button, she offers to mend them, creating an intimacy both comforting and painful. Their bond exists in a liminal space, neither romance nor friendship, but something uniquely suited to their circumstances. When Moira gives Dwight a pogo stick with Helen Towers painted on it for his daughter, she accepts his psychological reality rather than demanding he acknowledge his family's death. "Sharon wouldn't mind me doing this," Dwight says as he kisses Moira, a tender moment where past, present, and the impossible future coexist in heartbreaking harmony. As radiation approaches Melbourne, society dissolves in a dreamlike fashion. Bank managers abandon record keeping, shops remain unlocked overnight, workers simply stop showing up. The concept of debt evaporates. After all, who will collect? Cars reappear as hidden petrol reserves emerge. Why save fuel when there's no future? Luxury vehicles previously kept in private garages now cruise the streets, driven by new hands. Yet remarkably, an unspoken understanding prevails. Take what you need, not everything. This period carries a surreal quality as people pursue final pleasures with both urgency and strange casualness. Skiers ignore seasonal closures, sailors take daily voyages, restaurants serve their finest wines without price concerns. Children skip school with parental blessing to enjoy the beach. The Australian Grand Prix, moved to August, becomes a symbol of this end times mentality, attracting triple the usual entries from risk-indifferent drivers. Despite fatal crashes, races continue. these deaths seem almost irrelevant against approaching radiation. The race perfectly captures how our perception of risk shifts when larger threats loom. Government-issued suicide pills force us to confront questions about human agency and dignity. Is ending suffering quickly more humane than allowing radiation sickness to run its course? Who has the right to make this decision for others, especially children? The scene where Peter instructs Mary how to euthanize their baby Jennifer remains one of literature's most haunting moments. If she outlives you, Peter tells Mary, she'll be left alone, crying and vomiting all over herself in her cot with no one to help. This impossible choice challenges our fundamental understanding of parental duty. The ethical inquiry extends beyond humans. Mr. Davidson's concern about his cattle potentially outliving humans reveals the complexity of our stewardship obligations. Characters maintain moral codes even when they've lost practical purpose. Dwight's refusal to fish before the season officially opens, stating he won't break the regulations of a foreign country, reveals how our humanity partly lies in the social contracts we construct, rules we cling to even as the world ends. The novel's closing chapters show remarkable restraint as radiation sickness reaches Melbourne. Characters face their end with dignity rather than melodrama, continuing daily routines despite growing symptoms. Peter Holmes approaches death methodically, preparing their home with care, filling hot water bottles, arranging their bedroom, following instructions on government-issued pill cartons. The scene with Peter, Mary, and infant Jennifer is devastating in its simplicity. They hold each other close, express their love, and take their tablets together. Dwight Towers embodies the naval code to the last. His submarine's final mission becomes symbolic as he leads his crew through precise military protocol, systematically flooding ballast tanks to ensure Scorpion rests on the ocean floor, maintaining principles even without witnesses. Moira Davidson's transformation culminates as she drives to Barwon Heads to be near Dwight, parking her Ferrari overlooking the ocean, watching Scorpion disappear beneath the waves. Her whispered hope that Dwight will wait for her suggests both romantic love and belief in continuation beyond death. On the Beach takes its title from T.S. Eliot's poem The Hollow Men, ending with, "This is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper," perfectly capturing the novel's quiet apocalypse of ordinary people facing extinction with whatever grace they can muster. The novel's power lies in its plausibility. When Peter and Mary discuss how the war began with Albania before spreading between major powers, we see how easily small conflicts escalate with nuclear weapons. What's truly haunting is how characters face their end. Through Dwight, Moira, Peter, and Mary, we see reflections of ourselves, our capacity for denial, need for purpose, desire for connection, and ability to face the unthinkable with dignity. In our world of nuclear proliferation and climate uncertainty, this warning resonates urgently. The novel makes us care about doomed characters, reminding us that how we live matters, even facing extinction. It leaves us questioning how we'll face our mortality, both individually and collectively.